Aziz Abu Sarah is a Palestinian peace activist, journalist, social entrepreneur, and politician. After watching his brother die of internal injuries following his release from an Israeli jail after a year-long detention for stone throwing, Abu Sarah first turned into anti-Israeli political writing. And then, this is Susan Vibrock, Telluride Inside and Out. Today, I'm honored to be speaking with Aziz, a presenter at the upcoming Mountain Film 2021. The subject at Mountain Film is also the subject of Aziz's latest book, Crossing Boundaries, A Traveler's Guide to the World, all about breaking down cultural and historical barriers through tourism. So, Martin Luther King once said, "We have learned to fly the air like birds and swim the sea like fish, but we have not learned the simple art of living together as brothers." Aziz, how do you define love and hate? And do you think it is harder to build bridges, meaning love, or build walls, meaning hate? Do you see fear and pride as the underlying causes of the latter?
Thank you, Susan, and that's a great quote from Martin Luther King Jr. And you know, it's still the same, unfortunately, today. Just before dying, Stephen Hawking, in an interview, was asked about the greatest threat to humanity, and he said, aggression against each other. That's the greatest threat that faces us, and that's why it's what I focus on solving. So how do I define love and hate? That's my life journey of going through both. I've experienced hate. I've experienced after my brother being killed. It's being empty. It's being bitter. It's all you think about is ill of somebody else, of how you can hurt somebody else. And too often when we are in that cycle of hate, we don't think we are really hating. We think it's justice. You know, somebody killed my brother. I want to hurt them back. So that's justice. That's how I interpreted it growing up. And the line between justice and between hate is such a thin line. And it's not even always what you do. It's why you do what you do. And so that's how I look at hate. And the way I look at love, actually, I come from a very conservative Muslim family, but I studied the Bible, and I remember reading this verse in the Gospel about love your enemies, and I looked it up in Greek, and I realized the word love here meant to entertain or welcome in. It's actually a verb, not a noun, and it's to welcome, to entertain, to host the person who you see as your enemy. It's an action, it's not a feeling. And that's how I define love, is when you do something good to somebody else who you might have an issue with, who you might see as your enemy, you still do good to them. And that's much harder. It is much easier to build walls than to build bridges. You are called as a hero when you build walls. But bridges, sometimes people look at what I do and they say, "You're naive. What's wrong with you? You think you can bring people together? Oh, very cute." But that's how we change the world. It's the harder path, but it's the right path.
Thank you very much for that eloquent answer. Now let's talk about your young life as a boy growing up in Palestine. You talked about growing up in a rather conservative Muslim family. What are some of the early life lessons your parents taught you? Was it hate for the other? Was that part of their story?
No, actually, my family, exactly the opposite. My mom was an orphan, grew up at another's family who took care of her and suffered a lot growing up. My dad's school, they found a bomb, or there was a bomb in his elementary school, couldn't go to school because of the war, ended up not going to school after the war because his family lost everything. And so they didn't want us to grow up in that way. If anything, my parents taught us to, one, not get ever involved in politics. They still don't like it when I do. They wanted us to care and love, but we didn't have any connections with Israelis. So that's really important to say. So everything I learned about hatred and about anger, it came from what I saw. I went home one day and from school, and I told my mom, I was maybe 8 or 9 years old. I told her, I'm not going to school anymore. This is it. I'm done with school. And she looked at me and she's like, you're like 9 years old or 8 years old. You can't decide you can't go to school. What are you talking about? I said, we were fired at tear gas. And I was afraid. I was terrified of going back to school because of the tear gas. And my mom had to sit me down and figure out how to deal with my fear of Israeli soldiers and of tear gas. And she gave me an onion. And she said, every morning you take an onion with you to school. And for a while, my brother took me to school and brought me back. But eventually, I had this onion that we believe if you get fired at tear gas, you cut an onion, you put it down up your nose, and you breathe it through it, and it helps you not suffocate. And unfortunately, I had to use it too often. So it wasn't really my parents as much as just so many things were happening around me. This kind of incident, my brother being killed, that just made me so angry.
Thank you for that. So, and that story about how you learn to hate is very, very well documented. But for the record, just share maybe the Twitter version of what triggered your rage towards Israeli Jews with the Mountain Film audience. And in rage, how would you have described an Israeli Jew?
How did I describe an Israeli Jew before after my brother was killed? To me, first, the only Israeli Jews I knew were soldiers, were Israeli soldiers who I had to go through their checkpoints to go to school. I had to go through their checkpoints to go visit family. As I mentioned, I was shot at, I think first time I was 7 years old, I was shot at. So to me, it was a person who's carrying a gun. And only after I was 18 years old, really did I get to know a different kind of Israeli. And some of these soldiers, you know, they were nice sometimes at the checkpoint, but still, you can't really have a dialogue with somebody carrying a gun and can tell you whether you can pass this checkpoint or not. That's not what dialogue is supposed to be like.
Okay, so an Israeli Jew was someone with a gun you couldn't really bargain with or talk with.
That's the only one I've seen, yeah.
Okay, now talk about the alchemy that transformed that hate into love, or at least like, for your former enemy of the soul. How after the alchemy would you describe
it? So wasn't, the amazing thing, it wasn't a purposeful change. It was in some way driven by need. I figured out after I finished high school that I needed to learn Hebrew. And the best place to learn Hebrew in Jerusalem is a place called Ulpan, which is where Jewish immigrants to Israel go to learn Hebrew. And I signed up for this class, and I was the only Palestinian sitting in a classroom where everybody else was pretty much either Jewish or a couple of tourists. And that was the first real interaction of me with Israeli Jews, my teacher, my fellow students, who were normal, just civilians, just like me. And not just like normal, we were on equal footings for the first time. Meaning we both were students, we were equals. And I've never been an equal. I've never been recognized as a human being. And my teacher, I remember coming to me first day in class and welcomed me in Arabic. And I was sitting, crossing my arms, being very much thinking like, they probably all thinking, why is this Arab here? They don't want me to be here. I don't want to be here. And she came and welcomed me in Arabic. And I was confused because she recognized me for the first time. Somebody from the, quote unquote, the other side recognized me for the first time. And this was my first interaction. This interaction continued. And I realized at that point how, you know, as we start talking more and having more in common, you know, some funny things like I love country music, and not many Palestinians love country music. In that classroom, I found a couple of Jews who did love country music, and we'll talk about Johnny Cash and things like that. But slowly we started talking about politics, and it was the first time I heard Israelis talk about, yeah, I want justice also for Palestinians. And that was such a surprising thing for me. And I realized at some point how we are divided not by just physical walls and checkpoints, because those are easier to bring down, that we are divided by walls of ignorance, walls of fear, and walls of hatred. And I wanted, from that point on, my life to be about putting cracks in those walls to bring them down in whichever way possible, not just between Israelis and Palestinians, eventually between every community that is divided with other communities, that we should not allow those walls of ignorance and of fear to stop us from getting to know each other.
Okay. This, you've given me a perfect segue to the next question I have, which is, when and how did you have an epiphany? Or maybe you didn't have an epiphany, maybe it was an evolution. But that, what was that evolution towards, and I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, Mejdi Tours?
Yes, Mejdi Tours.
Okay, so I want you to talk about that evolution, describe the company's mission, and in the world at large, are there other companies doing what you and your partners do? And if the answer is yes, you welcome that sort of competition. So that's a big question. The first part is, how did you get to the point of opening Mejdi Tours?
So I ended up doing a lot of work after in bringing Israelis and Palestinians together with organizations like Bereaved Families Forum and Combatants for Peace. And I ended up eventually in Washington working at the Center for World Religions, Diplomacy, and Conflict Resolution. And I met somebody who became like a brother to me, Scott Cooper, who's an American Jew. And Scott and I just were inseparable, doing every project peace work together. We were working in Afghanistan together. We were working in Syria together, bringing enemy groups, negotiating, so on. And doing this work together, we at some point realized that the kind of work we want to do, connecting people together, we want to do it on a larger scale. And we understood that travel is the biggest exchange program in the world. Just before the pandemic, the last year, 2019, where there was normal travel, 1.4 billion people traveled internationally. And we thought, imagine if those 1.4 billion people travel a little bit differently. What if they get out of the buses and they meet the people? They know, you know, get to really face their stereotypes, their misconceptions about the other. And, you know, I'm not talking only even about travel far away. I'm talking even about travel locally. For us here in the United States, traveling to get to know issues we don't know about in our own communities. The hardest travel sometimes is the one just down the street from you. And so we our mission was to create meaningful connections, get people to see the human being in the other. Yeah, also have fun and all of that, but really get to connect the world together through travel. Mejdi in itself means honor, respect. It's an Arabic word. And we wanted our travel to be focused on honor and respecting the locals, the travelers, and the places that we are going. We do it in different ways, by the way. It's kind of one of the ways we do it. For example, in Jerusalem, we have two tour guides instead of one. One Arab and one Jewish leading the trip together, not just arguing about the two different narratives, but actually bringing those narratives together. And you hearing a conversation instead of hearing a lecture from one person, and then meeting so many locals, from archaeologists to a historian to journalists to musicians to, you know, getting to really understand the feeling of the place, to religious leaders, that by the time you leave, you're actually in love with this place, because the best memories we often have are the memories of the experiences, the people we meet. And are there other companies doing the same? There are more and more ideas like this. Often most of the companies who are coming with these ideas are local, meaning, I know, in London there's something called Unseen Tours that is amazing, and it's growing as an idea in other countries, where former or current homeless people are leading tours, not about homelessness, but showing you the cities from a different perspective. And they are tour guides, so they're not doing a poverty tour. They're actually showing you London, but they're showing you London from a perspective you would have seen it not seen it before. A normal tour guide would not really know. So there are these ideas of, let's bring the voices of the people you normally don't hear on, you know, common tours. Let's bring those voices to everyone who's traveling so you understand the place and not just get this image, romanticized image of a country or a city that everything is cool and everything is picturesque. That's not real. So, yeah, so there are companies like this, and we want more and more companies because actually competition is healthy.
Terrific. Thank you. So more on major tours. What were some of your greatest challenges that you have faced with your company, and what have been some of the greatest moments of joy?
So greatest challenges. When we started in Israel and Palestine, it was hard to find guides who want to work with each other, Israelis and Palestinians in the beginning. That has slowly changed, and we got a community of those guides who trust each other, who love each other, and built a community, not even just tour guides. As we grew to other countries, redefining how we run our tours, where it's not always two tour guides, like in Israel and Palestine, it's clear two narratives kind of to people. In Northern Ireland, you know, nationalists and loyalists, if you're talking about. But in Serbia and Bosnia, it's clearly a Serb and a Bosnian or a Croatian. But in some countries we work, there are no clear two narratives. Often there are many narratives. But like in a place like Paris or London, people think there are no narratives. There's only one voice, one single story. And it takes more work to convince people. It sounds crazy, but I was speaking in an accelerator with top executives in travel, and they were laughing at me, saying, the guy who was talking to me was from London, saying, in London, we do not have those two narratives and three narratives. We don't know what you're talking about. And he was serious, unfortunately. So that's a challenge. But here, even in the United States, you know, we just launched our red and blue tours, but we also launched our tours focused on the civil rights in the South, tours focused in the Southwest on seeing the Southwest through the eyes of Native Americans, not just going to see the nature, but really understand why this place is important and holy to that community. So those are new areas for us, and trying to explain that this multi-narrative tours exist in literally every destination can be a challenge.
And
you say the greatest joy. Oh, there are so many. That's harder to answer. I think watching people or guides that transform through these trips and building the relationships that built are incredible. So let me see. When we just had the pandemic, at the first month, we sent an email to our email list and said, our tour guides, our drivers are not going to have job probably for a while. Can you help pitch in something? And within a couple of weeks, we had $50,000 in our bank account that we were able to distribute. And to me, that's amazing because some of the people who donated, they were with us maybe 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And they still chipped in and sent $100 or $200 because they had those real connections. And to me, that was a proof that our concept did work. The other amazing story is I attended one of my Israeli friends who is a tour guide wedding. And he's a Jewish Israeli, his wife, who Jewish Israeli. And they asked the Palestinian tour guide to officiate the wedding. And so you had a Palestinian with a yarmulke acting as a rabbi, officiating this Jewish wedding. It's something you have to know how unlikely that to happen. Maybe there are a handful of times of something like this happen. And I've watched that friendship happen because they got to know each other by working together as tour guides, and they became good friends, and then they became literally family. So those kind of moments to me, the friendships that are created through this work, makes it all worthwhile.
I can actually hear the smile in your voice. Just for the record, when did you open Meiji Tours?
About 10 years ago.
So you've had 10 years of these sorts of experiences.
Absolutely. And in the beginning, Scott and I kept our jobs and were doing this as a part-time. And about 5-6 years ago when we decided, okay, this is serious and we need to dedicate our time to it. And both of us quit our day jobs and went full-time in, not knowing how it will work. And it was the best decision we could have done.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. Now, how is it that you found your way to Mountain Film, or how is it that Mountain Film found its way to you? And what are you looking forward to most about speaking at the festival in Telluride?
What was the first part of the question? Sorry.
How did you find your way to Mountain Film, or how did Mountain Film find its way to you?
They found their way to me through common friends, connections. I think one of my colleagues I'm an explorer at the National Geographic Society, and one of my colleagues there mentioned my name to the team at the film festival. And the amazing thing is later, as I started talking to people there, I realized we have so many of those common relationships between the Mountain Festival and between myself. So it's I feel like I'm coming to see friends as I come to visit.
Wonderful. And is that what you're looking forward to most about speaking in Telluride?
Well, yes, I am looking forward really to see familiar faces, to see some friends and say hello to them. I haven't seen them, I think, in over a year. And just before the pandemic, I think one of the couples who I'm hoping to see, I haven't seen since March last year. But the other thing, this is going to be the first in-person event I have attended since March last year. So this is very exciting for me to see people. And my life is all I travel. I design our products everywhere in the world. I build the itinerary. So I'm always on the road, meeting people, speaking with people, and being home with the pandemic for a whole year and not traveling is just so different. And so I'm so excited. This is like my return to some kind of normalcy.
Great. Thank you. Now, finally, given the fact that many may choose not to travel anymore or may not be able to afford a major trip, what message do you hope the worldwide audience who will hear you speak will take away from your talk?
Right. And I recognize that. And first, I believe travel is not about distance. It's about the state of mind. So even if you're not going to travel thousands of miles away, every time you cross the street, every time you step out of your house and you meet somebody different in some way, that is traveling. So that's the first thing I want people to know. Don't think of travel as how far it is. And I the reason I wrote my book, Crossing Boundaries, A Traveler's Guide to World Peace, is because I wanted to give tips to people of how to travel, how to meet people as you're traveling, how do you act responsibly as a traveler, and then how do you see yourself? And that's my hope, is to convince us to see ourselves as ambassadors or as diplomats as we travel. We are actually peacemakers. We actually making a difference, and we have more power in making a difference as we travel, more than politicians, more than actual diplomats, more than actual ambassadors. We have more power because if we really adopt this vision of travel, we could change the whole world. If 1 billion people travel differently, it will change the world. So I'm very excited about this message, and I hope I can inspire people to rethink what travel is, to really understand how you can travel locally, and hopefully to recognize the power they have as they travel.
Thank you very, very much for your time. This has been Susan V. Brock, Telluride Inside and Out, speaking with Aziz Abu Sarah. He will be one of the few speakers in town at Mountain Film coming up in the end of May. Aziz, thank you for your time. Thank you for your work. Thank you for your message. And look forward
thank
to
you for having me. Thank
pleasure.
You for having me, and I look forward to meeting you in person soon.
Likewise. Likewise. Have a safe trip to Israel.